have read the book of Acts carefully, you might notice that when the Apostle Paul addressed the men in Athens, he gave a very different speech from when he addressed the Jewish people in a synagogue in Pisidian Antioch. There he was addressing people that knew the Bible, and so he could quote the Bible. And in Athens, he quoted two poets. But yet the message, the content of the message was very similar. The basic points, 5, 6 points, were actually the same exact ones. But so if you want, do you want me to pretend like you're Glendale students and I'll just read exactly what I wrote? Or should I adapt it just to Gateway, make it more Alhambra talk? Well, I'll start out as if you're part of the Glendale audience. It's a great honor to address you today on the subject of Darwinism and white supremacy. Not only because GCC and its students are dear to my heart, I've taught there for 4 years, but also because most of you have an innate appreciation for cultural and ethnic diversity. It's partly due to your student population of 11% Asian, 23% Hispanic, 2% Black, 52% predominantly Armenian, and some smattering of Anglo. Indeed, this is why we celebrate cultural events on this campus, such as Nevros, Martin Luther King's birthday, Cinco de Mayo, a Filipino fiesta, Chinese New Year, and the commemoration of the Armenian genocide. I myself am a bit of a mixed breed, having ancestors from Central Europe, Scandinavia, Scotland, and Mexico. Yes, Jacob, my great-great-grandmother came from Guadalajara, which is why I have a tan, a permanent tan. But sadly, even though we celebrate our diversity at GCC, there are some people in America and in Northern Europe who do not. The reason they don't is because they believe in the concept of white supremacy. Let me give you a few recent examples. Let's see if we can get this going here. Okay, I can see here. Oh, got to turn on. Hang on. Donna, I've got it here. Now. There we go. There. On June 17, 2015, a white supremacist named Dylan Roof opened fire on members of the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, killing 9 people. On August 11, 2017, neo-Nazis, alt-right, white supremacists gathered in Charlottesville, Virginia, to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee, right? Robert E. Lee was a Southern president of the Southern U.S. during the time of the Civil War, the commander of the army, that is, and he was the commander of the Confederate States Army during that time. After the rally, a white supremacist drove his car into the crowd of anti-protesters, the other side, killing one woman named Heather Heyer and injuring 19 others. Here we are at University College, London. On January 11th, 2018, what's that, 5 months ago, the University College London began investigating a eugenics conference that took place on their campus. That's basically saying white supremacy conference. According to The Guardian, the newspaper in the UK, the London Conference on Intelligence was said to have been run secretly for at least 3 years by James Thompson, an honorary senior lecturer at the university, including contributions from a researcher who had previously advocated child rape. This is going on in London, in one of the best universities. White supremacy, intelligence, we're the best of the best, right? It is rather mind-boggling to think that after President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, what is that, 1861 or 62, after the impact of Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, after we recently elected our first African-American president, after our cities and schools have become more international and diverse than ever before in history, particularly Alhambra, that today we still find ourselves enmeshed by those who hold to the doctrine of white supremacy. How is that possible? There are no doubt many reasons for this phenomenon, but today I would like to highlight one of them, namely the impact of Darwinism. Let me say at the outset that in my presentation that although I am critical of Darwinism, I'm not questioning any scientific evidence of evolutionary processes, nor do I question the age of the universe being 5 billion years or more, nor am I one who considers myself steeped in biological sciences. My critique of Darwinism stems from its claim that the entire world and all the people in it are here without a creator. Not the result, and not the result of some intelligent design. That everything exists through the random biological process of life without any spiritual realm or meaning. It is this single doctrine of evolution, that there is no God in the heavens, that we have no accountability to a supreme being, and that as physical human beings, we are essentially a piece of protoplasm waiting to become manure. It is this doctrine that I'm critical of. And so I would like to begin by examining an event in Charles Darwin's life, who lived from 1809 to 1882. So, the HMS Beagle, 1832. Charles Darwin was 23 years old. He arrived on the southernmost tip of South America on the HMS Beagle to drop off a few indigenous Indians who had spent a year or so in England before being returned by the ship's captain, Fitzroy. The Yaghan Indians were called Fuegians, after the geographic name of Tierra del Fuego. When Darwin first saw these Native Americans on the seashore, he was shocked at their primitive behavior, and he wrote the following in his journal. I read this one quote to you guys before, maybe a year or two ago. Darwin said, "There can hardly be any doubt that we are descended from barbarians," meaning these people. The astonishment which I felt on that first seeing a party of Fuegians on a wild and broken shore will never be forgotten by me. For the reflection at once rushed into my mind, such were our ancestors. These men were absolutely naked and bedaubed with paint. Their long hair was tangled. Their mouths were frothed with excitement. Their expression was wild, startled, and distrustful. I think I might have it here. Is it here? Yeah, it's coming up there. They possessed hardly any arts, and like wild animals, they lived on what they could catch. They had no government, and they were merciless to everyone not of their own tribe. I would as soon be descended from that heroic little monkey or from that old baboon as from a savage who delights to torture his enemies, offers up bloody sacrifices, practices infanticide, right, the killing of infants without remorse. He treats his wives like slaves. He knows no decency, and he is haunted by the grossest superstitions. So seeing these men from an undeveloped tribe on the earth, Darwin felt no compassion, only disdain. And yet, 34 years later, the man on the right, Thomas Bridges, a Christian linguist named Thomas Bridges, moved to that very region, that exact point, with his family, and he learned the Yaghan language. And years later, this man, Thomas Bridges' son, Lucas Bridges, wrote a book about his father's experience, and he contrasted his father, Thomas, with Charles Darwin. He said this in his book, "The belief that the Fuegians were cannibals was not the only mistake that Charles Darwin made about them. Listening to their speech, Darwin got the impression that they were repeating the same phrases over and over again, and therefore he came to the conclusion that something like 100 words or 200 words would cover the whole language of the Yaghans, of the Fuegians. But we as children who learned to speak the Yaghan language, we knew that even though there was limitations, it was infinitely more richer than and more expressive than English or Spanish. My father's Yaghan English dictionary contains no fewer than 32,000 words and inflections, not 200. Why do you suppose that these two men viewed the Yaghan Indians so differently? The answer comes when you examine their two worldviews. According to Darwin, all living things on this planet can be divided into two kingdoms, the plant kingdom and the animal kingdom. And man, Homo sapien, does not have his own kingdom, but he simply evolved through random natural forces into the most intelligent of animals. And furthermore, according to Darwin, within his own species, there is inequality. So a man's value is based on his strength or his intelligence, that is, his genetic advancement on the evolutionary scale, and not from any intrinsic value. Thomas Bridges, however, he viewed the world of living things in three divisions: the plant kingdom, the animal kingdom, and the kingdom of man. In his understanding, man was created with intrinsic value, regardless of strength or intelligence. So let us examine these two worldviews represented by Darwin and Bridges. According to Darwin, we evolved as the highest animal. According to Bridges, we were created in the image of God. According to Darwin, there's monism, right? Material body. All we consist of is a material body. David, any kind of, like if you think of Velia as having personality and character, when she dies, if you were still living and she died, that whole idea of her personality is actually just your imagination. She was just all this time material matter that was, and chemical reactions happening in her that produced something that you thought was Velia. But there's no personhood there. It's just her body and her mind working the way it does. But Thomas Bridges said, no, there's dualism, right? We believe there's a material body and a soul, an inner soul. The soul lives on forever. The soul of a person is the real person. The body is just what we occupy and what we use to express ourselves. But we are in there. I remember when my stepfather passed, I thought, you know, I held his hand at 1:30 in the morning, and Harry Mormon breathed his last, and I realized when he stopped, oh my gosh, Harry just left. I knew he had left because there was nothing. It was just a shell, just his cadaver. But not according to Darwin. Everything is just material only. That's all there is. So also, related to that, according to Darwin, we have determinism. According to Moses, we have free will, or Thomas Bridges. What does that mean? That means this, that everything you do, Robert Vasquez, is already predetermined by your instincts and by chemical reactions happening in your brain, and by the way, the universe just is. So when you do a certain activity, it's only your, just like an animal that has instincts, right? Our little cat, when she goes to the bathroom, interestingly, afterwards she flicks her hind legs and she wants to bury that. I said, well, that's pretty cool, but that's an instinct. And so Darwin believed that every human behavior was instinctual, everything we do. So if a woman, think about the implications. If you, Lupe, had your son that you love so much, or your daughter, and you decided that you wanted to give up your kidney to help save their life, and you died in the process, we at your funeral would say, wow, Lupe is a tremendous woman. She gave up her life so that her child could live. Darwin would say, no, she's simply doing what's instinctual. She's an animal only. She just did what her mind told her, that this is what you're supposed to do now. So that means also that if a gang member comes around and takes a girl's the wrong neighborhood, it's like, gone. You can't blame him for a crime when it's his instinct. He's strong, she's weak, it's my turn to take over, boom. That is determinism. You have no control over how you act because it's already predetermined by your chemical reactions in your brain. And Thomas Bridges and Moses said, far from the truth. You have a free will. And you are responsible for your choices. And when you do something wrong, you'll be judged for it by your supreme creator. And if you do what's right, you'll be rewarded for it because you did good. That's why we have words in our language like good and evil and wickedness and righteousness and villains and heroes. In Darwin's world, there are none. There is no such thing as a hero or a villain. It's just the way it is. According to Darwin, a man has functional value only. According to the scriptures, he has intrinsic value. I don't care if he has Down syndrome. He's a human being. I don't care if she's 93 years old and can't cook for herself anymore. She's a human being. She has intrinsic value. We are born equal with innate human rights. According to Darwin, no, we're born unequal. Only the strong have rights. He says therefore, morality is totally relative. Whatever society decides for now, fine. They can make up their laws. We say, no. Morality is universal. It's for all time. Everybody knows in every society that killing is wrong. Stealing is wrong. Lying is wrong. According to Darwin, human life is disposable because it's just animals, right? According to Moses, human life is sacred. You don't take a life. Only God does that. Now, in Darwin's Descent of Man, he has a statement. At some future period, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races. So in his mind, there were two kinds of people. There were the civilized and there were the savage ones. We're the superior race and they're the inferior stock of humanity. And they're going to exterminate and replace the inferior stock, the civilized ones. And then the break between man and his nearest allies will be even wider, for it will intervene between a man in a more civilized state than even the Caucasian. If you can imagine that. The Caucasian is the highest form of the animal's kingdom. He said it's going to intervene between man in a more civilized state than even the Caucasian and some ape as low as a baboon instead of now between the Negro and the gorilla. So let me get this right so you see it. This is how he saw it, right? You have the baboon, then you have the gorilla, then you have the African, but finally you have the Caucasian. This is the world of Darwinism. And he says the two middle ones are going to die off because they're weaker, the black man is weaker and the gorilla is going to be weaker, or maybe the white man will go exterminate him, just kill him, genocide. But however it happens, it's going to happen, and then there's going to be a bigger gap between the baboon and the white man, or maybe even something better than the white man, the Superman that Hitler wanted, right? So let's look at these, I want to read one more thing back here. Yeah, here. The U.S. Declaration of Independence was based on what model? Darwinism or Moses? What, Jim? Totally on Moses, right? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They're not evolved equal, they're created equal, and that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. And that among these are the right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. So I don't care, Javier, if you are Bill Gates, a billionaire with lots of money, you have the same right to life as a little baby born in East LA, because they're both human beings. Bill Gates and the little guy. Since these two worldviews differ dramatically from one another, which should not surprise us that they coincide with two different views of the origins of humanity, right? Darwin espoused that the out-of-Africa model of man's origin, whereas the biblical view espouses the Mesopotamia model, right? So Darwin said man came out of Africa. He evolved slowly, and people now, the Darwinists today, say it was about 100,000 years ago that we have our common Eve, and she and her man and her family, whatever, they migrated out of Africa, and then they believe that something happened on that route that transformed the more rudimentary and the more juvenile or the more primitive man into suddenly this modern man that could, oh my goodness, he could do all these things. In his chapter entitled Comparison of the Mental Powers of Man and Lower Animals, this is what Darwin said. That woman there is a Aboriginal Australian woman, photographed maybe 100 years ago. And this is what he said about them. He said, the rest of mankind, especially Africa and Australia, were not much higher than the primates. In his chapter entitled The Comparison of the Mental Powers of Man and the Lower Animals, this is what he said. No animal is self-conscious, that he reflects on such points as from where he comes or where he will go or what is life and death and so forth. And then he makes a statement, how little can the hard-worked wife of a degraded Australian savage who uses very few abstract words and she cannot count above four exert her self-consciousness? Or how can she reflect on the nature of her own existence? So this woman, according to Darwin, was just a shred above an ape. So obviously the blatant racism of Darwin is not shared by most scientists in our generation. So I'm not saying, please don't misquote me, I'm not saying that today's evolutionists are racist. What I'm saying is that today's racists embrace fully Darwinism. And they are more prevalent than you might realize. You consider National Geographic. The latest issue, you might have seen it in the stores, black and white, beautiful issue that they have, a beautiful magazine. I ordered myself a copy. And I read through there, and lo and behold, in the front article was an article of apology from the editors of National Geographic about their racism. This was a white man's magazine for 150 years or whatever. The editors apologized and said, look, in a full issue, we acknowledge this, we bring it up in the past to show you how racist we were. In a full issue article on Australia that ran in 1916, Aboriginal Australians were called savages who rank lowest in intelligence of all human beings. Where did they get that word savage from? Guess who? Darwin himself. That was 1916. But sadly, I kept reading, I read and found other articles from there, and I found a racist view not that long ago, maybe 2006, was it? This one right here. Yeah. National Geographic, The Greatest Journey. That was just a few years ago. This magazine endorsed the view that certain African tribes represent a more primitive language and intelligence. This is what they wrote. Ancestral DNA markers turn up most often among the San people of southern Africa and the Biaka pygmies of central Africa, as well as some East African tribes. The San and the two of the East African tribes also speak languages that feature a repertoire of unique sounds, including clicks. Like, think of it this way. I had a missionary friend who lived in Zimbabwe, and she told me one time, she gave me some words that use these clicking sounds, and I thought that was so cool. If I was a mom, and I wanted to tell my son, hey, come here, now, and he didn't respond, I could say, meow, and add my little meow. They go like that. Or they have all these different clicking sounds that they add to it. But anyway, it's very interesting. So anyway, he's thinking, this author thought that the click sounds means that they must have been very primitive, right? Perhaps, he goes on to say, perhaps these far-flung people pay witness to an expansion of our earliest ancestors within Africa, like the fading ripples from a pebble dropped in a pond. Some archaeologists think that the migration out of Africa marked a revolution in behavior that also included more sophisticated tools, wider social networks, the first art and body markings or paintings. Perhaps some kind of neurological mutation had led to spoken language and made our ancestors fully modern, setting a small band of them on course to colonize the world. So what is this guy saying? These far-flung people who are using this primitive language with clicking sounds? Kind of like this. He was thinking maybe the baboon goes, woo, 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 ha, ha. And the San people go, ng-ng-ng-ng-ng. And then finally, ah, oui, je parle français. There was no neurological mutation that put them on course with spoken. He calls them spoken languages, as if these people were only clicking around. I get the impression that he's never studied the Khoisan language, this African family of languages there. Because if he had, he would never make this comment. He made the same conclusion that Darwin made, right? He said, oh, it sounds like they have 200 words in their vocabulary. It must be very, very primitive, you know. But the Khoisan language is just as sophisticated as English or Arabic or Cantonese. Remember, Cantonese has 6 to 9 different tones, as well as the, you know, A, E, I, O, U sounds and the consonants. They have these tones that make it even more sophisticated, more complex. And in the same way, the Khoisan languages, some of them have 15 different clicks that they add to normal sounds, so they can make all these different distinctions and meanings. And Sendawe, a Khoisan language, for instance, has a dictionary that's 232 pages long. Thousands upon thousands of vocabulary in their word, in their language. All right, well, anyway, in contrast to this out-of-Africa model, we have the Mesopotamia model. There's Mesopotamia, East Turkey, North Iraq, that area. You know what Mesopotamia means? What does it mean? Meso, in the middle. Potamia, potus, it's the water, between two waters. In the middle of the Euphrates River and the Tigris River, that is Mesopotamia. It starts from Mount Ararat, and it goes all the way down to the Gulf of the Persian Gulf. So the biblically based model says that man's origin was there. We descended from one human family recently, not millions of years ago, not even 100,000 years ago. Perhaps only 5 to 10,000 years ago, from eastern Anatolia and northern Mesopotamia. Okay, so now we have this very interesting concept called the most recent common ancestor. This is a phrase, MRCA, that is used among paleontologists concerning our mother, right? We all know we have... Everyone knows this now. It's a fact that every single human being has the mitochondrial DNA of one particular woman way back in history. And everyone has her. I mean, some of us have, you know, let's say we go back 5 generations, we may be related, maybe we're not. If you go back 15 generations, a lot more of us will be related, right? But if you go back 45, 50, 60 generations, bingo, we see, well, hey, wait a minute. This woman's DNA is in every single tribe on Earth. Every single continent has her markings in it. So they call her the most recent common ancestor that we have. There she is, Noah's wife. That would have to be Noah's wife. According to Genesis, it would be. So according to Genesis, the Hebrew sacred writings, everyone living today descended from a single family of 8 people. And this is how Moses described it. The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. These 3 were the sons of Noah, and from these, the peoples of the whole earth were dispersed. It's interesting that we have today 3 kinds of people, yellow, black, and white. and there were three sons of Noah. Maybe that's not a coincidence. Interestingly, the ancient Chinese character for the word ship, if you look at it, they'll explain it, it's made up of three characters: boat, eight, people. That's it. That's a ship. Why eight people? Why eight individuals? It goes back to the story of Noah. They knew there was a flood, and they knew the original family of man had eight people. When Douglas Rhode of MIT did his research on our MRCA, he was doing it through a computer analyzation of the DNA, and he came back with two different models saying the exact same conclusion. He says our MRCA, the MRCA of all present-day humans, lived just a few thousand years ago. The original one said 5 to 15,000 years ago, which would match up exactly with what Genesis says. So that would have been, we're saying it would have been Noah's wife. That's what I believe. At this point, I want to illustrate these two claims of man's origin with a set of photographs, okay? Natalia Ivanova, this was a huge gift from God to me. I met this lady online. I didn't meet her online. I mean, I saw her website, and then I contacted her, and she's an award-winning photographer in Paris, and she's taken portraits of women from 100 different countries and ethnicities. She lives in Paris, and so there's a lot of people in Paris. So she got them, and she takes the photograph at exactly the same place with exactly the same lighting, and she allows very little makeup, and she wants to compare all these women between 18 and 30 from all these different nations to see what their features are like and see the skin colors. And her point is to say, les origines de la beauté, you know, the origins of beauty. Beauty is everywhere. She's a wonderful lady. I contacted her, and I said, hey, could I use some of your photographs in my presentation? And she said, not only can you use them, but you send me your video. I'm going to put it on my website. She was so excited about what I was doing. I couldn't believe it. So here they are. So you get 24 beautiful, exquisite, stunning photographs that she sent me in high-quality imaging. So I'll show you the first one. This woman here is a Fulani woman from Central Africa. According to Darwinism, our mother would have looked something like her. But you look at her and you say, well, I can imagine the rest of African tribes coming from her, but it's really hard for me to think of Europeans stemming from her, or Chinese, or whatever. The same token, if our MRCA came out from Northern Europe, this is a British girl, we'd say, well, okay, I could imagine the Scandinavians coming from her, maybe the Germans, maybe other ones, but I don't know about the Chinese. She does not look like she could give birth to someone that would end up being Chinese, nor much less African. Or we look at a Chinese woman. Okay, maybe the Filipinos came from her, maybe the Koreans, maybe Japanese, maybe the Laotians, Vietnamese, so forth, but I can't see the African in that, and I cannot see the European in that. Okay, so now let me show you a photograph of a woman that she took in Paris whose DNA stems from the foothills of Mount Ararat. She has what I would call the perfect middle features of the earth. You can see that she could be the mother of the Asian, she could be the mother of the African, and she could be the mother of the Indo-European. If we were to travel, for instance, from her and go to the south, we find an Arab woman, just slightly different than her. If we go further south, we come to Ethiopia. We cross the Red Sea. There's an Ethiopian, two Ethiopian women. Interesting, huh? They don't look exactly like American blacks because American African Americans came from West Africa. They came from the most extreme part of Africa. But when you look at Ethiopians, they look much closer to Middle Easterners because it was a slow migration away from Mount Ararat into the ends of the earth. Let's look farther. We come to Gambia, I think, and then finally this woman, the Fulani woman. The skin gets darker, the features get more pronounced. Every one of them is beautiful. Every one of them was God-made. But they migrated farther and farther away from Mesopotamia. And as they got farther, the sun grew hotter, their skin developed what it needed to adapt to the high sun and the hot sun and so forth. So let's take, there's now going around West Africa and all the way up towards one of the islands off of Africa. It gets lighter. You can see her skin. And then finally, we'll end with an African, but she's from Algeria. Watch this one. Look at that. If you saw her the first time, you wouldn't necessarily say she was African, right? But she is. Okay, let's start again with this woman. We'll call her Naomi. I told the audience, I said, if I tell you what nationality she is, you're all going to get stuck up. Because half the audience was Armenian, and she's from Armenia, but anyway. The woman to her left would be like the women are in Turkey, as you go westward toward Turkey. She's heading towards Europe. This is a Romanian on the left. Then a French woman on the right. See their skin color? Their eyes, their nose, their lips, everything is more European. There's a German girl on the left, and finally the British girl on the right. They get more extreme in a very slow process of immigration over time. If we started again with the woman that I'll call Naomi, and we go towards India, this is an Indo-European group, right? She goes toward, there's a Bangladesh girl, and here's a Tamil girl. Darker skin, but still Caucasian features, right? Because they're part of the Indo-European family, part of the family of Japheth. Now watch this. This is most fascinating. When we go northeast from Mount Ararat towards Georgia and Azerbaijan and Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, northwest China, Mongolia, Korea, Japan, I mean Korea, and finally China, this is what happens. Watch their eyes. Korea and China. Okay, so if I show you the whole thing, if you're able to go up closer and see it, you'd recognize that there was clearly a slow process of change over several thousand years of migration from Mesopotamia to the northeast, to the Mongolian peoples, to the northwest, to Europe, to the southeast, to India, and finally to the Arab Peninsula and Africa. And when you look at Naomi, you could see she could be the mother of every one of them, or the grandmother, you could say. In other words, when you look at just the simple facial features of the, and you compare these women with what is said in the book of Genesis, it matches up beautifully. It shows that in our earliest state, there was no white, there was no black or yellow, there was only Middle Eastern. Everyone had the same color of skin. It's really only when we look at the extreme end of every continent that we see the unique physical features emerge. Of course, a Chinese, a British, and a Rwandan or a Fulani woman look very different from each other. But if you go the same direction and you just go from Anatolia to Turkey, and you go up to Azerbaijan, and you go down to Saudi Arabia, well, then they're very similar because it's just the beginning of that migration, right? We can see the same window into history when we look at the human languages today. So here's the numbers 1 through 10 from English, Dutch, German, Swiss, German, Spain, French, Iranian, Romanian, Greek, Armenian, Kurmanji, which is Kurdish, Farsi, Tajik, Pashtun, I can't read it there, Kashmiri, Hindi, Nepali, and Bengali, okay? But you can see the words are very similar to each other. When I count in Kurdish to my audience, I say, yek, tu, se, chor, pen, shesh, haft, hash, nat, da. They go, whoa, that sounds like Farsi. That sounds like Hindi. That, even a Bengali girl says, I understand you when you say that, because she's from Bangladesh, and it's still similar to that. And of course, we see these words as they come, like we say in Kurdish, bench, for five. In Greek, penta, like pentateuch, right? Pentagon. In Italian, cinque. In Spanish, cinco. In French, cinq. Fünf. In German, five. Six is shesh. Hex, seis, or say, seis, six, six. And it goes on, if you go up to, in fact, I'll show you one number, just the number six. Look at that. Just one word, if you look at all the different places, including North Africa, including across the Arab Peninsula, they're all related. They're almost the same word. They change just ever so slowly. So if you were from Bangladesh and you said, well, I'm going to count to 10, or my number six is Choi, you'd say, well, that's certainly not related to six. Aha. But it's a long spaghetti string, right? It goes six, zex, seis, hex, shesh, shash, cha, Choi. Oh my gosh, they're related. And the same thing is true if you take in another group of languages, the Uraltaic family. Turkish, bir, iki, üç, dört, beş, altı, yedi, sekiz, dokuz, on. I talked Turkish one day to a man. I just wanted to find out what it was like. He was living in Urumqi, northwest China, which is a Turkic people, Mongolian people. And I said, Ben Türkçe konuşacağım. Sen anlıyor musun beni?
Evet, anlıyorum.
He understood me. We could talk. He could talk Kyrgyz. I could talk Turkish. And we could understand each other. Because of this right here. A long migration from Turkmen, Azerbaijan, Uzbek, Bashkir, Tatar, so forth, all the way to northwest China. In fact, I've done this before. You guys laugh at me. My kids always laugh at me when I do this. I'll show you a micro version of it, right? If you go down the Rhine River and you're talking to a man with his family and he stands there trying to communicate to you, and he says in Konstanz, "Das ist meine Tochter." You go, "I don't know what you're saying." Take it down to Mainz. He says, "Das ist meine Tochter." You think, maybe I know. You go down to Rotterdam. He says, "Das ist meine Tochter." You cross the English Channel. He says, "This is my daughter." Oh, okay, I got it. I got it. I understand you now. If you cross the Atlantic to New York, he says, "This is my daughter." Finally, you come to California. "This is my daughter." That's how we say it, right? Right? "Das ist meine Tochter. Das ist meine Tochter. Das ist meine Tochter. This is my daughter. This is my daughter. This is my daughter." Right? Here we are in California. We're just flat as can be. Just surfer English, you know, kind of. Why do we have the G-H written in the word daughter? D-A-U-G-H. It's because we used to say doctor. And we traveled. That's how they migrated. From Mount Ararat, they came into the Alps of Switzerland, and they went right down the Rhine, and they crossed over. And lo and behold, then when the pilgrims came to, you know, America, and that's why those languages change every single 500 miles or every single, you know, chapter in the human migration history. So if all these things are true, that we originally all came from one family, that at one time we all spoke the same language, that we all had the same color of skin, that means that we are all related to each other. Kathy Lopez, you're my cousin. Not just a sister in Christ, you are my cousin. We share the same grandmother, right? It has tremendous ethical implications. We cannot treat each other as foreigners or enemies, right? Rather, we must treat each other like family and like relatives. Ultimately, we should not treat other human beings according to their functional value, their wealth, their strength, their abilities, but rather according to their lofty position as a member of the great worldwide human family. In this scenario, there can be no caste system like in India, the untouchables, you know, just above animals, no. No preferential treatment of certain tribes or nations. There can be no white supremacy. There can be no African supremacy. There can be no Asian supremacy. Only a growing appreciation for the colorful and unique cultural traits of each human tribe on earth. And this also abolishes any supremacy of wealth or education. As the Declaration of Independence says, all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their creator with rights. That among these are the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Moses wrote it this way: when a foreigner resides among you in your land, you do not mistreat him. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native-born Jewish man or woman. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. This concept of treating everyone equal goes way back to Moses. It's not just Jesus' comments. It goes way back to the Pentateuch. But as we look at Darwinism, we encounter a different scenario in their ethical. How does their ethics work? I want you to see this. I know it's going to take me maybe 45 minutes to finish the lecture, but I want you to see what happens when you take Darwinism and you play it out in terms of your ethical life. In the great evolutionary journey from ape to man, in the great competition for the strongest members of the species to survive and the weakest members to die off, there is one cardinal rule, and that is man is not born equal. The value of a human being is not intrinsic. His value increases with intelligence and with strength. And it is for this reason that Charles Darwin and those who followed him referred to the superior and inferior groups of human beings. So Francis Galton, who was a second cousin of Darwin, he coined this word eugenics. Eugenics, you, good, genics, birth. Good birth. You're of noble birth. You're of good birth. You've got good DNA in you. They've got bad DNA, right? In order to encourage the governments to decrease the population of inferior humans and increase the population of superior ones, one of Darwin's children, Leonard Darwin, he served as the chairman of the British Eugenics Society, right? That's the British Society of White Supremacy. And he wrote this book right here. What is eugenics? Leonard Darwin, son of Charles Darwin. I looked on eBay and I found one copy left. I didn't care what it cost. I wanted to get my hands on this. I ordered it, it came to me, and I started opening it up, and this is what I found in here. I want you to see this for your own eyes, because it would never, ever appear out You won't find this in any library today. This is Leonard Darwin, right? He talks in chapter 7 about inferior stocks. It has been said that the future welfare of our nation might be greatly improved by attending now and paying attention to the breed of the coming generations. This could be done by either making superior stock leave more children, right? Or inferior stock have fewer descendants behind them. That's how we'll do it. The method of dealing with inferior stocks will be first considered. There are two ways of acting when the aim is the production of smaller families by persons of bad stock. And these are persuasion, and if that doesn't work, compulsion. As to the inferior types, we cannot, as we have seen, reduce the number of their descendants by the simple expedient of murder. All that can be done is to lessen the size of their families through sterilization. Can you imagine a conversation with Leonard Darwin and Heinrich, let's say the eugenics professor in Berlin? Leonard, what are we going to do? How do we get rid of this stock of humanity that is pulling us down? And he answers him, well, I don't think we could resort to the expedient of murder, but what about sterilization? We'll rid them in one generation, and we'll have the pure Aryan race. Wow. So he goes on to write, how are we going to do this? So this is all about sterilization. How do we sterilize the peoples that are of inferior stock? And this is when I just about dropped my jaw. I read the next page, and I could not believe it. This is written in England. It was introduced by the president of Yale University, who was also a eugenics professor. And I came to this page, and I saw in there, what, California? What is this about California? And I read this, and this is what he said. How is experience to be gained if no one is going to make the first move, right? If no government, somebody has to make the first move and start sterilizing people. Luckily, there is one place in the world, the only one place, to which we can look when seeking for practical information in regard to sterilization, and that is the state of California in the United States of America. I'm going, you've got to be kidding. There it is. According to the 2003 Chicago Tribune article entitled California Confronts Its Eugenics History, the memos show, and these are memos that were found, by the way, Caltech. They had like 60 boxes of these memos, of these profiles, of these files of everyone who was sterilized in California. Memos show how California's civic leaders helped popularize eugenics around the world, including Nazi Germany. Case histories offer a glimpse of the more than 20,000 people who were, by law, sterilized in California state hospitals from 1909 into the 1960s. Does anyone here know that that was being done? Anyone remember? You remember that, Ernie? And there was a governor, what was his name? He made an official apology about it. Trey Davis, is that his name? Ray Davis, yeah. Whatever the governor was, his last name was Davis, back in the 60s, and he made an official apology. Of course, I was too young to really know what was going on. But that had to do with sterilization program here. And it goes on to say, they were sterilized in state hospitals from 1909 to the 1960s in anticipation of curing an array of social ills, from poverty and promiscuity to overcrowded institutions. That was it. 20,000 Californians were sterilized. And you know what? I looked online for more of them, and I found a couple of profiles. They went ahead and scanned them so you could see them. There was a Hispanic girl. It says she's Mexican-American, 19 years old, promiscuous. Her IQ was 60. Needs to be sterilized. And I thought, oh, you know what? I know what that means. The IQ test at that time was written by a pair of Anglo professors who were writing questions that an Anglo home, a household, would typically talk about. The kinds of things that were in literature at the time and stuff like that. Well, this girl who was 19, who was Latino, she didn't have access to all those books. She didn't have all, so she was deemed as 60, IQ 60, she should be rid of, you know, or at least not have children. In fact, I saw another graph and it said the largest population of people were not the blacks, it was Latinos. Latino women were the highest single category of sterilized Californians. As the guardian, and it gets worse. This gets worse. That's why I want you to hold on, because I wanted you to learn this, know this, and when someone tells you, well, you know what, we are all evolved from apes, you can say, well, now, wait a minute, I got something to say about that. And you don't have to deal with the scientific evidence, just deal with the ethics of it. Just say, have you really thought about what you believe when you say we're evolved from apes? And where this is leading to? As The Guardian pointed out in their 2003 article, Hitler's debt to America. This is Hitler's debt to America, right? There are certain things he could not have done without the help of people from guess where? California. A California eugenics leader, C.M. Gauthier, right here in Pasadena. In fact, they met, unbelievable. The more I was reading, I was saying, no, this can't be. This is my own barrio. How can this happen right here in Pasadena? It was in the Southwest Bank building. Marengo in Colorado, that beautiful building with the Roman arches. I think it was built in 1906 or something like that. In the third floor, room 321, was the, what was it called? The Human Betterment Society. No, the Human Betterment Foundation. And it had professors from UC Berkeley, from USC, from UCLA, and then from Stanford. Those were the ones who crafted this policy that we should sterilize all people who have these problems. And get rid of them. Get rid of their kids, at least, if we can't kill them, right? The expedient of murder, well, we can't exactly murder them, but we can at least sterilize them. And he writes this letter. So there's one man, he went to Germany, this is in 1934 or so. One of the men in that group, I think this was the guy in Caltech, he went to Germany to help the new regime there, unter Adolf Hitler, that wanted to learn how to sterilize their people, right? So he writes back a letter to his colleague in this place right there in that building. He said, hey, you'll be interested to know that your work has played a powerful part in shaping the opinions of the intellectuals behind Hitler in this epic-making program. This is before Hitler became the anathema, right? This is before he did all the killing of the Jews. So he was big stuff back then. He was like, wow, he's really progressive. He's helping their people. He's going to clean up the nation, all that stuff of all the handicapped people and all the other non-necessary people. Everywhere I sense that their opinions have been tremendously stimulated by American thought, and particularly by the work of the Human Betterment Foundation. I want you, my dear friend, to carry this thought with you for the rest of your life, that you have really jolted into action a great government of 60 million people, meaning Germany. And it was only later that the world learned how far Hitler was to embrace this worldview. We sterilized 5,000 people in 10 years and finally 20,000 over the 1960s. In Germany, the people were sterilized 5,000 a month, and they finished with 355,000 sterilizations based on the things they learned from our neighbors right here in Pasadena. But unlike Leonard Darwin, who maintained that the government should not reduce the inferior population by the simple expedient of murder, Hitler disagreed. In essence, he told himself, ja, warum denn nicht? Why not? It's more expedient. Genocide is much quicker. We can get rid of them right away. In one generation, boom, they're gone. 10 years. And then he proceeded to exterminate the lives of millions of inferior stock, namely the handicapped, the gypsies, the Poles, and the Jews. So to conclude, I would like to ask you the question, is there a place on earth today where racism has not reared its ugly head, a place without hate crimes, where peace reigns, where you are not judged by the color of your skin, where the people treat the world's tribes and nations as one large family? I would say the closest thing we have to a city of justice today, which I've mentioned to you before, is the city of Geneva in Switzerland. The Genevan citizens are unique in this manner that they are concerned about the welfare of the entire world. If you look up at their newspaper, Tribune de Genève, you would be amazed at the articles you'll find. They report news from every geographic region and from every field of human interest. The only thing you can't find there is about the Kardashian family. They have a truly global perspective on life. Geneva is a host city to 22 different international organizations that are dedicated to the well-being of our planet. They include the World Health Organization, which is fighting Ebola right now in the Congo. They include the World Trade Organization, the International AIDS Society, the Red Cross, the Red Crescent, the United Nations, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, the Geneva Conventions, right? There were humane treatment of POWs, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, everything. All these organizations, 22 of them are there in Geneva, in one city. The question is, how did they become this advanced in their thinking that prejudice and bigotry are virtually nowhere to be found? If you go back 500 years, you'll discover the answer. From 1536 to, there's Geneva, beautiful city. There's the international organizations. From 1536 to 64, a man named John Calvin spent 28 years of his life delivering over 2,000 lectures on the Bible, resulting in a city whose leaders were steeped in the biblical worldview. In his book, The Institutes, he says this, I think you can see it up there, all the blessings we enjoy are divine deposits committed to our trust on this condition that they should be dispersed for the benefit of our neighbors. With this mindset, the city fathers established the first school to educate children. They founded the University of Geneva. They began a welfare system for the poor, and they built the city's first hospital. Over the years, they welcomed refugees from other countries who were persecuted for their faith. They sent emissaries into different countries to help plant the seeds of Reformation, including France, Holland, Italy, Hungary, Poland, and even Brazil. Is it any wonder that 500 years later, Geneva should become host to the largest humanitarian agencies in the world? I hope you remember after today that regardless of where you came from or how much you know, you are a treasured member of the human race. You are not a mere animal. Your life is sacred. You have just as much to contribute to our society as anyone else. I stand before you as a handicapped man, an amputee who is missing a leg, and yet my life is still infinitely valuable. I am not part of an inferior stock of humanity, and neither are you. Thank you. Why don't you come on and pray?